Most Americans had never heard of Blackwater until 2004, when Iraqi insurgents killed four of the private military contractor's employees and hung their mutilated bodies from a bridge in Fallujah. But the company's name recognition jumped dramatically 3 years later, after a Blackwater security team killed a dozen Iraqi civilians in a crowded Baghdad traffic circle. Despite all that press coverage, little remains known about the billion-dollar company's media-shy founder and owner, Eric Prince. Suzanne Simons follows his career in a new book called Master of War. It's published by Collins. I'm very pleased that it brings Ms. Simons, who is an executive producer with CNN, to our show today. Hi.
Hi, how are you doing?
I'm okay. Eric Prince granted you more than 100 hours of interviews and access to Blackwater's top offices and facilities around the world. Why do you think that he did that after avoiding the press for so many years?
Well, I think, as an executive producer with CNN, I had pushed to get access. So we were putting together what ended up being a half an hour special on the industry as a whole. And this was after the Fallujah incident, but well before what you described happened in Nisour Square in Baghdad. And I think he was getting such negative coverage in the media, partly because he wouldn't engage, I think. There was another author who wrote a book about the company and never had an interview with anyone in it. And I think that he was so tired of that he was willing to take a risk if he thought it might be a little more fair.
Well, there were two concerns he had. One, he felt that time spent on public relations was wasted. But also, didn't he claim that the U.S. State Department prohibited him by contract?
Yeah, he was kind of in a difficult position because while he was working for the Department of Defense and the Navy, he also did have this contract with the State Department that called for any media interaction he had to be approved by a contracting officer there. And so they sometimes got approval and sometimes didn't get approval. And one of the more interesting things, I think, in the book is an email that I have in there from one of their people who are helping manage the contract from the State Department, just absolutely going berserk after the company granted an interview to the Weekly Standard. And it's fascinating because it really highlights the tension between the government and an agency that it's paying to do its work overseas.
But would Blackwater have been able to weather the crisis that resulted from the deaths of those Iraqi civilians in 2007 if he'd paid more attention to the company's public image?
I think he thinks so. When I traveled with him to Afghanistan shortly after that shooting, I asked him, I said, do you think that the media is going to be your Achilles heel? Is this what's going to bring you down after so long? You've just avoided them and thought they weren't important. And he said, it's quite possible. So I think he finally had come around to thinking that maybe he had done something wrong.
Well, of course, the real thing that went wrong was the incident in which those people were killed. And Iraq passed a law earlier this year prohibiting Blackwater employees from working in the country. Is that why the company changed its name to Z?
Yeah, in part. The word that Eric Prince used to describe his own company was radioactive. And that was one of the reasons why he made that trip to Afghanistan in the weeks after, after that shooting, because he wanted to kind of gauge for himself what the perception of his company was like. The problem for him was always that he was hearing from his government clients and the people who would come to the Blackwater facility in Moyock, North Carolina, very positive feedback. You're doing a great job. We're very happy. And the contracts continued to come in. So he felt like as long as that was happening, he didn't really have to worry about the public relations campaign. But at the same time, potential clients didn't really know much about his company other than what they heard in the media. And I think that's the real catch-22 for him. And ultimately, that's what caused them to change their name and try to kind of fly below the radar if they could.
Well, where did the two names come from, Blackwater and Z? Z spelled X-E.
Yeah, it's I think it's an undetectable gas or something like that. And I think
Xenon.
Yeah, exactly. And that speaks volumes for where he wanted to take the company. He wanted to be undetectable. He didn't want to have this kind of media attention that Blackwater had attracted for so long. And the name Blackwater as well had come from the land in Moyock, North Carolina, that they had chosen to build this training facility on, because they really started only as a training facility for special forces and law enforcement until the Iraq War, of course.
So they're out of Iraq, but are they still working for the U.S. government elsewhere as
yes.
Z?
They certainly are, yeah. And Presidential Airways, which is another one of the companies that Mr. Prince owns, they're working for the Department of Defense in Afghanistan right now, and they're flying clients from military clients and personnel from one place to another. They're also helping train Afghan border police, which is definitely no easy job given the borders and what's happening over there.
Well, it began, didn't it, as a place that wanted to provide privately owned training facilities for the U.S. military. How did it grow to do all these other things?
That was the most fascinating part of researching this book for me, was answering that very question. I think he had the right idea with the training facilities. There was certainly a need among the Special Operations Group in the late 90s for better training facilities that weren't quite as far away from home for those who had to go there and train with their teams. But once the Iraq War happened, I think you had a lot of people inside the Pentagon who were privately kind of warning that we didn't quite have enough people to handle the job in Afghanistan and Iraq, taking into consideration the enormous reconstruction efforts that would follow. And what happened is they just started looking around for people who were already on the government-approved contracting list, and Blackwater happened to be one of them. And Eric Prince, having a keen sense for business, jumped on that opportunity and started putting his name in the hat for things like personal security details. And that's where these armed Blackwater contractors come into it.
But it also fits in with the Bush administration's campaign to privatize many things that had been previously the responsibility of the military.
Exactly. I think a lot of people were kind of scratching their heads when they were hearing the warnings that there weren't enough people, and very few of them realized that Dick Cheney had already done some looking into this after the first Gulf War, and he already knew that the model for using private contractors to support the military efforts kind of worked. He obviously had a lot of ties with KBR and Halliburton, and I think that, you know, that's why we saw the enormous explosion in the numbers of contracts. The thing that I think people weren't as prepared for is a lot of those contractors do things like drive people from one place to another. They serve up breakfast to the troops. But they weren't prepared for the fact that some of these guys were going to be very heavily armed in situations on almost a daily basis where they could potentially be in an exchange of fire. I think that was the real thing that Americans weren't ready for either.
Well, Blackwater also exacerbated that situation by costuming its employees in these superhero-type outfits.
Yeah, they looked like tough guys, didn't they? Yeah, I think that's another thing. You know, when you understand Eric Prince and sort of his upbringing and his military service and his he's got an incredible strong will. He's very stubborn.
He
had been a Navy SEAL, yeah, himself.
And did that prepare him for the sorts of things that he was offering?
I think it did, yeah. But it also dictated the way that he ran his company. For example, if you had a company that was relatively new, that was all of a sudden taking in hundreds of millions of dollars in contracts, you might look around to other Fortune 500 companies for people with experience in business and leading something that large. But what he did instead was looked to friends who had been former SEALs with him or people who he knew in the military, who he knew and trusted. Trust was a very big issue for him. And I think what happened is you got people who were kind of learning as they went, if you will.
My guest is Suzanne Simons. Her book, Master of War, is published by Collins. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. So he started off with this private training facility, and little by little we have all these other things that air transportation, intelligence, other services. This is just a matter of synergy that one thing led to another expansion of services?
Yeah, partly that and partly just he's probably one of the most intense people I've ever met in my life, and he doesn't really have a lot of downtime. He's constantly thinking of new ideas and ways to make money. And another thing that he did was start sort of a private intelligence company, if you will, and he hired a couple of guys who had quite impressive careers at the Central Intelligence Agency to help him get that off the ground. And the idea was to kind of through open source records, and, of course, their contacts, I'm sure, sort of advise other companies who were looking to do business overseas. Now, he's not the only person who's ever done that. You see that happen a lot with people who leave intelligence agencies in the government. But I think he was the only person who really had the means, you know, the resources financially to get that off the ground and attract the kind of people he did right off the bat.
Well, how did he started off mainly working for the U.S. State Department, didn't he?
He actually started out after the bombing of the USS Cole. His first big government contract was with the Navy. They had come to him because he had already kind of been training the SEAL teams a little bit here and there. And they realized after that bombing how incredibly unprepared they were for the terrorist threat. A lot of the guys on the ship that day that it was attacked had never even fired their weapons, if you can believe that. So the Navy designed its own training program based on the new threat and came to Blackwater and said, can you guys handle this for us? And they said, absolutely. And that was really what got the ball rolling. And, you know, word of mouth works like everything, you know, in normal society. It works the same way inside the government. He started getting, you know, some good recommendations from people in the Navy, and he started getting other contracts.
Which were taking care of the State Department, providing security, the sort of thing the military had done in the past. And then he also started working for the CIA and USAID?
Yes, yes. They started in Afghanistan, actually, guarding some of the CIA sites there. And they also started working for, obviously, the Department of Defense with the airlift and air support. That was really one of the things, too, that made him so valuable to the government and to the State Department, because he could afford, literally, to go out and buy a fleet of planes and then lease them back to the government. And there are not a lot of individuals, or even companies for that matter, who, you know, are sort of bound to turning a certain amount of profit every year to keep the stakeholders happy, who could do that.
So but doesn't really the U.S. have a lot of planes all of its own? I keep on hearing about our military budget being used to pay for building more and more planes.
Apparently they don't, because they lease out quite a bit. Another thing that was shocking to me, too, was I couldn't believe that the U.S. military didn't have enough personnel to take care of keeping our diplomats alive in Iraq. That was something that they just came back and said, I'm sorry, we don't have enough people who are trained to do that. And that's why Blackwater got that contract with the State Department, because the military said it didn't have enough people.
Do you have any idea how many employees Blackwater had at its peak working for the government agencies in Iraq, Afghanistan, and elsewhere in the Middle East?
They had about 1,000 in Iraq when they were really in their heyday. And that number now, obviously, they don't have anybody left in Iraq, but they've still got quite a few people working in Afghanistan and other countries around the world, because they're still on this contract with the State Department that also includes rotations guarding U.S. embassies around the world.
You're right that the company eventually had 40,000 operators in its database available at any moment's notice.
Yeah, it's kind of incredible if you think about it. It's almost like a small army.
And most of these people with military backgrounds or law enforcement backgrounds?
Yes, quite a few of them. Quite a few. And he looked for the special operators. I think those people were always close to his heart. So he looked for them first, but then, you know, the demand obviously became quite a bit higher, and he started hiring people from law enforcement, perhaps people who didn't have as much experience. If you look at this team of guys involved in that shooting in Nisour Square in September 2007, I think the majority of them were all under 30. So that, you know, you really have to ask yourself, how much experience can you have in a military theater when you're that age?
How much money did Blackwater earn from government contracts in a typical year? Do we know?
In a typical year, no. That was one thing. He wouldn't open up the books to me, and he didn't really want to talk. He would always talk sort of in ballpark figures. But if you just do, which I did, a rough estimate of the contracts that are available for the public under the Freedom of Information Act, it tallied well over $1 billion. Well,
wow.
Over a billion.
And then he wasn't the only private contractor working in Iraq and these other places.
If you can believe it, he is one of about 170 private contractors.
So we're talking about many billions of dollars.
Isn't that, yeah, absolutely.
How does the cost of paying private contractors compare to the cost of equipping and paying traditional military personnel?
That's always been a question that hasn't really had a clear answer. There was a government agency that came out about a year ago and said that, yeah, it kind of really does make sense to hire contractors because you're not expanding the military. You don't have to worry about paying pensions for the people who provide service for the military. You don't have to worry about keeping them housed. You don't have to worry about their medical expenses. With a contractor, it's very easy. You might pay them a lot of money right up front, but then you're done. You can, you know, let them go completely when you're finished with them. I don't know that I've seen enough evidence that I really believe that's the case, but that's what certainly what the industry is putting out there.
Well, Blackwater executives have been portrayed by the media as mercenaries and profiteers, paid billions of dollars in U.S. taxpayer money. I get the feeling that you don't believe Eric Prince was only in it for the money.
I don't. I think that was a big driving force for him, though, and that probably came from his upbringing. His father was a businessman, and I think he truly, while he felt like he was doing this for patriotic reasons, he knew he wasn't doing it for free. He certainly said to me at one point, you know, this is a business, it's not a charity. And I think he kind of wanted to live up to his father's expectation of being a good businessman. His father died of a heart attack in the late 90s, and he owned an auto manufacturing facility in Michigan. He actually, his company was responsible for inventing the little lighted mirror and the sun visor that you probably have in your car. After he died, the family sold that business, and he used his money for this. I think part of it is patriotism, because I don't think a lot of people become Navy SEALs unless they have a true love and passion for their country. But there certainly was a drive to make profits in this. There's no doubt about it.
Although, because of the family money, he probably could have afforded not to work at all if he had wanted to.
Exactly. That's what a lot of people who support him say. You know, he could have sat back and done nothing and lived a life of luxury, but he didn't. He got out there and he hustled every day. It's hard. It was very difficult for me to paint him one way or the other, and I tried very hard to state a lot of different perspectives in the book so that people could make up their own minds. I think, you know, the company has been so heavily politicized already, there was no need to go out there and try to repeat that.
Although you can be very idealistic and still leave a lot of bodies in your wake.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and, you know, part of that, I think, too, came from the fact that there's a different mindset between a contractor and the member of the military. Because remember, the military is over there to win hearts and minds so that eventually they can leave, right? That's what we've all heard. But with the contractors, they're over there for a different mission. And in Blackwater's case, they were over there to keep the people they protect alive, and that's it. So the military got very frustrated with them because they wouldn't accept risk. And if you look at what happened that day in Nisour Square, it's a perfect example. Now, his guys, who are all being prosecuted right now, by the way, all said they're not guilty because they thought they were coming under fire. And so they just unleashed the incredible firepower that they did. But when all the smoke cleared, there were, you know, 17 Iraqis dead, including a 9-year-old boy. Now, if that had happened by the military, it would be a much different story. You'd have a court-martial system where the guys would be held accountable. There would be a trial. And what's happened now, these guys are being prosecuted, but this is one of the first really big cases. So it took us some 6 years for the Department of Justice to kind of catch up with how we're going to hold these people legally accountable.
I'm talking with Suzanne Simons, who's an executive producer with CNN and the author of a book published by HarperCollins called Master of War. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. By the way, don't forget to check out our video section on our show page. You can take a peek inside our studios with guests like Julie Powell, Andy Borowitz, and Buzz Aldrin. Just click on Video Picks. This is WNYC and WNYC.org. We're back with Suzanne Simons, whose book, Master of War, is published by Collins. Did this grow out of something you were doing for CNN?
Yeah, it did. I worked with our senior international correspondent, Nick Robertson, a few years back on a sort of a wider piece looking at the industry. And this was before really anyone had heard of these guys, and nobody really knew what they were doing. We put together a half-an-hour special. But, you know, at the end of the half an hour, I realized there was just so much more here to be told. And certainly enough to fill a book, so that's what I chose to do.
Well, there's some really interesting details. For example, Eric Prince offered to go into Darfur and clean up that mess in a short period of time. There's a kind of a cowboy mentality here.
Absolutely, absolutely. He's not a person who likes to be told no, and I think he gets very frustrated with things that don't make sense to him. There's another good example in the book from his younger years of when we're really seeing that form, when he was at the Naval Academy. And he had been on a trip with his parents, and he had cut his hand and needed surgery to get it done. But that meant he was late getting back to the academy, and he was going to get in trouble for that. And he just thought that was so stupid, and it was just such a short-sightedness that he left the academy that he had tried very hard to get into. So I think, you know, he's a person who really doesn't have a lot of patience, for things that don't make sense. And Darfur is one of the things that just doesn't make sense to him. He doesn't understand why people have to die and why the U.S. isn't doing more to get in there and take care of it. And when you have the kind of resources that he has, you kind of understand why he would want to get in there and do it. However, when you also realize the complete lack of oversight on behalf of the government with these contractors, you kind of worry a little bit.
Well, I wouldn't want him going into Darfur to clear up the situation.
Probably because you'd be worried about oversight issues and who's watching him.
And a bunch of dead bodies in his wake, as I said before. He also, use his own funds to pay for the development of an unmanned Blackwater airship that could take aerial photos? And didn't he look into creating a jungle skill survival center in the Philippines?
Yeah,
did anything come of those ideas?
He didn't have a lot of success with those, no. And he put a lot of money into it, too. There was one thing he was really getting frustrated by, you know, reading in the paper every day and seeing on TV how many people were dying and how many of our troops were being killed by IEDs in Iraq. So he decided he was going to put his money into research and development for coming up with a new armored vehicle that he called the Grizzly. And it looks like that, too. It's very scary to see. But, you know, it was engineered so that it would deflect the brunt of an explosive device and hopefully save the lives of troops. He put several years into this. He created an entire assembly line in his Moyak property. He built several of these vehicles. But then when it came down to it, the government decided to go with another company. So he didn't sell a single one. So I think he's learned the hard lessons. He was very bitter and very angry about that because he was so convinced that this was the best thing out there. He's learned some hard lessons about business and about possibly coming across as too arrogant to people in the military who felt like he was out there saying he could do their job better than they could. I think he's learned quite a few lessons.
Well, your mention of the Moyak property in North Carolina reminds me that he held a reception for friends and potential clients in April 2006 when he opened that 60,000 square foot facility. Yes. Were you invited?
I was invited. I think I was one of the very few members of the media who were invited. I know there were a few others, but they didn't show up.
You've written that the doors leading into the building's lobby had 50-caliber machine gun barrels for handles and that at the end of the event, Blackwater's new parachute team jumped out of a plane overhead and floated down.
Yeah, they definitely know how to put on a show, I have to tell you. They bussed people around. They showed them demonstrations of the shooting ranges. He was very frustrated by the Columbine incident in which it took police so long to respond to that he started an Are You Ready high school on the grounds as well, where he could train law enforcement personnel to move quickly into a building to secure it if that were to ever happen again.
Does he have clients beyond the State Department and other U.S. government agencies?
Oh, yeah, yeah. He's still doing quite a bit of law enforcement training. Probably law enforcement right there in New York go down there to train. I know they do in Georgia, where I'm from. I know they do in the Virginia area. They really come from all over the country to train there.
And what about his sister company, Greystone? They have been working with foreign countries, haven't they?
Mm-hmm. Yep. They hire people from foreign countries, and they put them to work on contracts for the United States government. And a lot of that it's not secret. I mean, the government actually calls for certain positions in the contract to be third country nationals, for example. They can't be an American. They can't be an Iraqi. They need to be from somewhere else. I think the government does that for cost-saving reasons and because they feel like that's an acceptable risk that they can take for some jobs. And that's pretty much what Greystone does. They're sort of like a clearinghouse for the recruitment of contractors, if you will.
Was it Greystone or Blackwater that was contacted by Benazir Bhutto to help provide her with security leading up to her election in Pakistan?
I'm not sure technically which company it was. They all sit under Prince. I mean, you can call them anything you want. He's involved in every one of them, and they're all sister companies. They lend resources to each other. So I think at the end of the day, you know, the name changes are to try to keep things a little under the radar and not very effectively. But she did ask for protection, and apparently it wasn't approved, and we know how that ended.
Well, Blackwater has a reputation for being overly aggressive and difficult to work with. Is this something that happened over time, or has that been part of the Prince concept?
I think it's part of the company culture, to be honest with you. Because he runs the company more like a military unit, because he, at the end of the day, he is the man who makes the final decision. I think because he hired people who had a similar mentality and a similar view and a similar background. He didn't really have a lot of people advising him who came from different arenas, who came from, you know, business as much as the military. And I think over time that really hurt him. And then, you know, he did hire some people from the government who eventually quit because they didn't like the way things were being run.
One private contractor was reported to have run a U.S. general off the road with his armored vehicle. Was it ever determined whether that was Blackwater or someone else?
I don't think it was Blackwater, but another part of the problem was Blackwater was the one that was really out there so often with the reputation, with the bad press, that pretty much any time anything went wrong in Iraq for a while, people assumed it was Blackwater.
Well, they killed other Iraqis other than the most famous incident,
yes.
People who were non-combatants. Before that 2007 massacre, they killed a guard for the Iraqi vice president on Christmas, even in 2006. And May 2007, a Blackwater contractor shot and killed an Iraqi driver near the Interior Ministry. I mean, I could see where the Iraqi government might be a bit uncomfortable about their presence.
Yeah, absolutely. I can, too. And I think the shooting on Christmas Eve in particular was very disturbing because it really also showed, once again, the lack of oversight. I mean, our troops kill people when they're over there, and sometimes it's an accident. But there's always an investigation launched, and if something was wrong, there's a clear court-martial system where the people are held accountable, they have a trial, there's a justice system. Well, that was never in place for the contractors. So when they're out there on the streets in dangerous situations and they're armed and someone gets killed, it's almost like you kind of shrug your shoulders and move on to the next day, because what are you going to do? There's no clear structure overseeing these guys and no line of accountability. And that was really the most frustrating thing, I think, for me, because it didn't make any sense to me how the government could throw so much money at these guys and then have absolutely no idea how they were going to hold them accountable for doing anything wrong.
Well, on the one hand, Prince was upset that the State Department didn't defend Blackwater's actions in the traffic circle incident. And on the other hand, Iraqis were incensed by the killings because Blackwater personnel as employees of the United States had been granted immunity from local laws.
Right, right. But that was something that Paul Bremer did when he handed over power to the Iraqis. He made sure that these guys would be immune. And this year, the Iraqis overturned that. And January 1st, they kicked them out. So I think, you know, that's another sign of just the growing frustration and the obvious very focused, almost precision mission of Blackwater. They didn't really care what the Iraqi government thought. They were there, paid by the State Department to do something, and that's what they were going to do. And they didn't really care, once again, about the hearts and minds or the relationships or the PR or any of that.
Well, the State Department had to make a decision when the Iraqi government demanded that they fire Blackwater, but they kept them on the payroll because they said they needed at least 1,500 agents to replace them, and they couldn't get them.
Yeah, that was probably the most shocking thing to me when I was sitting at the State Department. I was talking with Ambassador Kennedy, and he said that, you know, we couldn't do our job without these contractors. I mean, we just couldn't. And I thought, oh my gosh, this is, you know, the United States of America, the largest military in the world, and you know, the diplomatic corps is extensive, and you're telling me that we can't carry out our diplomatic mission without this one company and this one man.
So who's providing security for the State Department in Iraq now?
They've changed to another company called Triple Canopy, which was also on the original contract. The way the original contract was written, there were three companies, and Blackwater had most of the deal. So it took them, what, about 16, 18 months, but they were able to finally phase Blackwater out of the Iraq work and then bring in the other companies to take more of their responsibilities.
We have some statements from our listeners. David from Brooklyn called in to say, isn't contractors a euphemism for mercenaries?
Yeah. Yeah, that's a great question because that's what they used to be called. And, you know, people who consider themselves contractors take great offense to that word because they feel like it's just so evil and they firmly believe what they're not doing or what they're doing is not evil. And I think the word contractors came about really out of a PR initiative from a guy named Tim Spicer, who works over in the UK. He's a British guy. And, you know, the Pentagon's also paying him about $600 million now to kind of oversee the contractors. So we've got contractors overseeing contractors over there. It's gotten out of control.
Well, part of the problem for the government is without a draft, there are fewer people going into the military. And they, as we learned in Iraq, our resources have been stretched.
Exactly.
So they're hiring these people. But the big issue would be oversight. Have there been attempts to to introduce more oversight?
There have, but they've been very slow in coming. There are a few people who have really been pushing for this up on the Hill, and they're realizing themselves as they go along how complicated it is. There was some legislation passed that covered contractors who were working for the Department of Defense, but what they didn't realize at the time was that that legislation didn't cover contractors working for the Department of State. So we still don't have anybody, I think, in Washington who has gotten their head around the whole picture and realized how these contractors are intertwined and has been able to introduce and pass legislation that covers all of them.
Had we used private contractors in other wars, World War II, Korea, Vietnam?
Well, sure. If you remember, I mean, even the Revolutionary War was almost all people who were hired to come and fight on behalf of the United States. So that's, you know, Lafayette Square across the street from the White House. You know, those guys were all hired help, all mercenaries, if you will.
And the Hessians were fighting for the British.
Yeah, exactly. So it's certainly not anything unheard of. I think the most shocking thing about it, though, is how much we're using them now and how it almost came out of nowhere and almost as an afterthought for the war in Iraq. And like I said, I think if there were going to be an organized structure for using these people at the right time, that there would also be clear legal channels, clear organizational channels as to who they report to. Another big problem the Pentagon has is they have people who just are not experienced handing out hundreds of millions of taxpayer dollars to these guys. So I think, you know, there's certainly a place for contractors, and I don't think they're going away anytime soon. But I think the government is just having a very tough time catching up to what it started.
Well, many people associate this, as I said earlier, with the philosophy of the Bush administration. Have we seen any changes now that the Obamas are in the White House?
Not so much, no. And I think it's because they just don't have a choice. Like I said, I mean, I don't think that one of the first things that President Obama would want to do is bring back a draft, like you mentioned. And he realizes that this is something that he cannot do. He cannot sustain the operations in Iraq and Afghanistan without the contractors. I was really interested to see what would happen with Blackwater when Hillary Clinton took over at the State Department. And I think, you know, we saw what happened. I mean, the Iraqis called for them to be kicked out, and I think it was like the next day, maybe 2 days, when you got the statement from the State Department saying they're done over there.
Has Eric Prince read your book?
He has. He wanted to read it before it came out, and I really wanted to, you know, not put out the perception that he had anything to do with it. So I kind of held off for a while, which wasn't easy. He's very stubborn and persistent. But I finally gave him a copy about 10 days or so before the book was released, and I haven't heard back from him. I did hear back from his president, though, Gary Jackson, over the weekend, who thought the book was extremely accurate and gave a very accurate depiction of the culture of the company.
Well, that's a compliment, because your attempt, as you said at the beginning, was to be fair.
Yeah.
To not politicize this, to simply tell the story. In a situation like this, you could almost assume that people are going to be offended by something that
right.
is written in the book. And as you've also suggested, Eric Prince is a bit of a control freak, so I would think that would be another thing that you'd have to worry about.
Yeah, exactly. And like I said, I think he started bothering me in April because he wanted to know what was in it. And, you know, I only made him one promise, and that was that I would give him the opportunity to respond to criticism, which I think is fair and I would do for anyone. And, you know, there were some really difficult conversations we had. I mean, conversations about his personal life.
Well, we have to leave it there, unfortunately.
Oh, yeah.
Master of War is Suzanne Simon's book, which is published by Collins. I want to thank you so much for being with us, and we've got to get into that personal thing some other time. On tomorrow's show, Catherine Bigelow, director of the new critically acclaimed movie The Hurt Locker, and the film's writer Mark Bowl. Then Aaron Brown on the plight of North Korean refugees. Also, the director and one of the subjects of a new documentary called Blood, Sweat, and Gears about an American cycling team's quest to compete in the Tour de France. Plus, two Iranian authors, Roya Harkakian and Azar Nafisi, talk about what it's like to watch the events in Iran from America. The Leonard Lopate Show is produced by Blake J. Schick, Stephen Valentino, and Jerry Corcoran. Melissa Egan is the executive producer, and we had help today from Natalie Pano, Miranda Schaefer, and contributing producer Virginia Doris. Debbie Fountain was at the audio controls. I'm Leonard Lopate, your host. Thanks for listening. We will see you tomorrow.